Everything the Lord has is a good thing. At the same time, it's just stupid cold out there. I was at a concert last night, and there was like a Vivaldi concert, and the first chair violinist got up and spoke, and she talked about how cold she was experiencing America because she was from a different country. And you're like, okay, maybe she's from Brazil. It's really cold. She was complaining about the cold here, and I kid you not, she was from Siberia. At that point, I like literally started Googling, like, what's it in Moscow right now? Like, this is just dumb. We're in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 as we continue in our series on this cold morning. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, as we ask this question, is this really it? Hope for the skeptic and the disenchanted, that we walk alongside Solomon in this incredible book. And we're going to read verses 1 through 11 this morning as we begin. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, is it mad? And of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what is good for the children of man to do under heavens during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses. I planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks. I planted them in all kind of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possession of herds and flocks, more than anyone who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of men. So I became great and surpassed all that who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward for all my toil. Then his conclusion in verse 11, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. The question that Solomon comes to the text with this morning, it is an ancient philosophical question. The question, very simply, is what is good? We see this in verse 3. I searched my heart with how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, how to lay hold of folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do during the few days on earth. This is the question that drove Solomon. It's a question we see lived out in various things. And in this moment, he is asking for pleasure and comfort and how they might produce this good life. The question of the good life, it's important to recognize how philosophical that Solomon is. I believe I would put Solomon as the most philosophical writer in the Christian, or the Bible, the biblical canon, and probably the Apostle Paul II. But he writes with a philosophical bent, and he's asking this question that has been asked by philosophers for centuries, for millennia. What is the good life? Aristotle sought to answer this question, and he, along with other Greeks, had this concept of eudaimonia, meaning the good life. This is the question, and for Aristotle, his answer was the golden mean, which he called the moderate path between excess and deficiency. Epicurus would come along and say the good life is actually a life of pleasure and to avoid pain. Keep on a high long enough, fast enough, far enough, and you've lived the good life. The Stoics, in opposition to Epicurus, or they in opposition to the Stoics, called the good life accordance. Basically to say you look at the best possible version of who you could be as a person, and then you live into that. And if you can live in accordance with the best possible person that you can imagine, you have lived the good life. They talk about the citadel of the mind, whereas if bad things happen, if difficult things happen, whether you're rich or you're poor, or you got pleasures or no pleasures, as long as the citadel of your mind that you remain focused, you can live the good life. Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism, ancient Chinese philosophy dating back to 600 BC when he lived, said simplicity, spontaneity, flow is the good life. We don't have to master what's going on like the Stoics or master it into our mind, but really just get in pace and flow with what's happening in the universe. Buddha had the good life he called the middle way, to avoid the attachment to sensual pleasures and to avoid aestheticism. Okay, there's a lot of reasons I don't want to say that wrong. Okay, to that word, to thread that needle is the good life. Nietzsche, in the 1800s, German philosopher, anti-Christian in particular, more than anti-God, anti-Christian philosopher, said authenticity and self-governance, that's the good life. Not to be told what to do by some Christian God. And he famously said, God is dead and we have killed him. Kant, 1700s philosopher, talked about virtue, courage, morality. That is the good life. Each one of these people dealing with this exact question, what does it mean to live a good life? In 2018, 97,652 college freshmen were asked the question of what they are after, what's their major life goals. 83% of college freshmen say a major life goal of theirs is to be rich. One of them study said, was given the question of, well, are you sure that being rich would make you happy? And the quote was, well, I'd rather cry on my yacht than in my Subaru. Prison Mike, who is a fictional boss of Dunder Mifflin, passionately tries to get his employees to convince them that they have a good life. And he says, the way you know you have a good life is you have a nice boss, have nice coworkers, and you don't have to eat your own hair. Whether you're a transcendentalist, an existentialist, or a Rastafarian, all these philosophical backbones of our current even thinking have sought to answer this question. What does it mean to live a good life? And I love how Solomon, as he steps up to the plate, he says even more than just trying to answer it philosophically. Several times in the text, he says, I tried to answer it in my heart. What does that mean? It's not just out here of philosophically, this is good. He was trying to answer it for himself. Kevin Warwick says this, I feel that we are all philosophers and that those who describe themselves as a philosopher simply do not have a day job to go to. Each one of us answers this question of what we believe amounts to the good life. And even more so than that, each of us, even as we enter this morning, will smell the milk carton of whatever we have going on in our own life and ask, is this good? Is what I'm experiencing, does it pass the sniff test? Am I living the good life? Solomon in verse 1 and in verse 3, come to this question. He says, I have said to myself, come now, I will test pleasure. and find out what is good. And in verse 3, I wanted to see what was good for people to do under the heavens during the few days of their lives. First conclusion, there's just two conclusions that we'll come to about the good life this morning. The first conclusion Solomon comes to is this: chasing a life of pleasure and comfort is a disappointing way to live. Chasing a life of pleasure is ultimately a disappointing way to live. We're going to walk through the text here. Keep your Bibles open. Get your pens out. This is really cool how Solomon honestly speaks of his journey to try to find this. There are 10 things that Solomon says that he used to see if pleasure and comfort could equal the good life. Each of these, twice in our text, he uses this phrase. It's really important on your Ecclesiastes cheat sheet in the pew pocket in front of you. Talks about this, that it says this is under the heavens or under the sun. That phrase means that he is trying to find the good life without God or God's perspective on it. That's what under the sun means. These are pursuits that are done under the sun. First thing, he says, I tried cheering myself with wine in verse 2. Proverbs, which Solomon wrote much of, Proverbs 23, 29 through 35, talks about the problems that come from too much wine. Solomon, in very eloquent detail, lived out this life of drunkenness and then articulated what it looks like in Proverbs 23, 29 through 35. Secondly, he says, I tried embracing folly, just living for the next thing. I didn't check what was in the account. I didn't think about the consequences. I didn't care who I hurt. I just lived for the next thing. Solomon, who wrote the book of Proverbs, again, so much of the book is about the difference of wisdom and folly, and he details out this life or these principles of folly that he lived out in his life. Third, it says, I built houses for myself. In verse 4, 1 Kings 7 talks about Solomon, his building this ornate housing complex around Jerusalem. It took 13 years to build these houses that he speaks of. Verse 4 says, I made gardens and reservoirs and ways of providing for these gardens. In Song of Solomon, it's not just about what you think it might be about. There's also this whole detailed aspect of what the gardens of Solomon looked like. Solomon, for his day, was incredibly scientifically aware, and he made a whole watering system in this arid land to provide this incredible gardens, which gave him pleasure. In verse 7, it says, I bought slaves. In 1 Kings 9, 15 through 17, Solomon, like many empires in history, used slaves to build his empires. His son would be even worse. And again, this is not activity that is this what God ordained. This is his under the sun. I used people for my own benefit to get ahead. Verse 6, I owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem. That's verse 7. In 1 Kings 6, 26, we learn that he not only had these herds and flocks, he was like a big horse guy. 12,000 horses. And actually, around Jerusalem, which is a pretty small place when you're there, around Jerusalem, they had these what they called chariot cities filled with horses and horsemen and chariots. He built this army of chariots and horses, 12,000 strong. That's in 1 Kings, we see that. Seventh, he says, I amassed silver and gold. 1 Kings 6 says that that everything that Solomon had kind of got covered in gold. Solomon was really into the bling. And it details in 1 Kings 6 what they did with the shields, how they overlaid gold all over the shield. And Solomon's throne, right, where he's hanging out, details this ornate overlay of gold, because it said in the scripture that he would get 666 talents of gold a year from foreign nations. A talent is 75 pounds. Millions and millions of dollars worth of gold were pouring into Solomon during his reign. The 700 wives that we often talk about with Solomon, and you think that is a really complicated life, but the 700 wives, they were all of royal birth. He was spreading out himself in order to gain more from the nations, and he amassed incredible wealth. I acquired male and female singers in verse 8. Music, as you see in the life of his father David and in Solomon, was incredibly important to Solomon, and so he tried to fulfill his life with the famous singers and concerts. Number 9, I acquired a harem. In addition to the 700 wives, he got 300 concubines, women that he could solely have sex with. Number 10, I became greater by far. We see this in verse 9, and in 2 Chronicles 9, it talks about his greatness. But you hear these verbs, right? Just run down them one more time. I tried, I built, I made, I bought, I owned, I amassed, I acquired, I became great. This is Solomon's attempt at the good life. And he gave it a big shot. In verse 10, it says, I deny, in conclusion of all of the things that he did, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I had the means. If I saw it, I got it. Anything I woke up that day and realized, you know what? I really want more of this. I want more gold. I want more concubines. I want more stuff. I want more chariots. Anything my eyes saw that looked good, I took it in. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my labor, and this was the reward for all my toil. And then we have the conclusion in verse 11. Yet, right? In opposition to everything you heard in the first 10 verses, yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and all that I had toiled to achieve, didn't mean anything. It was all meaningless or vanity, chasing after the wind, and nothing was gained. Here's our phrase again, under the sun. What he's doing is what he has done the last couple of passages we looked at, and what he will do in a few passages we look at ahead until chapter 5 is what we're calling this Hevel spiral. And pop up that graphic, if you will. And then we've talked about this, that this we see as a theme of what's happening in the book. First of all, Solomon wants something. In this passage, he wants the good life. He wants a life that is pleasurable, that is comfortable, that is happy. He wants this life, and he's willing to, and we see this in our passage, work really hard to get over the difficult toils, the unfair things that he would have to face, that he toiled to finally take possession of the thing. And when he got the thing, and in this passage he says, it's not just a thing, it's the 10 things that I got. And when he got all those things, eventually it led him to dissatisfaction and to, in future texts, will take him right back to, well, then I got to try something else. And this wheel eventually then turns into a spiral of what he says, none of this means anything. The Hevel chasing of despair. What I want to focus on is we're going to marry this passage with Ecclesiastes 5, and I'm really excited about this, because more than just what's happening here, more than just all of this like big list of how I'm bigger, stronger, better than anyone you've ever known, and I had everything, and it's all bad, and poor you who didn't even get all this stuff, and I'm saying even if you got it, it would be bad. That's a dark message. But built into this is an invitation. And it's an invitation that's not just for those old guys with beards who have done philosophy for a living or a lifetime. It's for your life and mine today. It's a built-in invitation for the chasers. Because you might be in this room and you keep finding yourself just searching for the next lover, just waiting for the next show to start on streaming, just hounding Zillow for the next house to come up in the next neighborhood. Or maybe you're moving from church to church to church, or you find yourself changing or moving job to job and nothing ever quite fulfilling. And you're looking to the next video to have this next idea of how to tune your body into to exactly that perfect thing. But you wake up and you're tired. And you're tired of just like, man, I'm so tired of spending my commute thinking, when am I going to get there? When am I going to get there? Or despair, I got there and it doesn't seem to do it. But you end up dizzy after a long season of life where you're going from thing to thing to thing. I believe what Solomon would say is you're at a pretty good place. You might be at the end, which feels pretty dark, of a cycle of chasing, but it gives an opportunity to be at the beginning of a new way to live. And while we have talked about this hevel wheel of despair, this meaningless vanity, this word he uses throughout the book, it's not the only way he describes life to be. And again, we've mentioned this 8 times in the book. It says there is another life and that God has given joy to man. So there's this chasing life. We're always after something. And there's the given life. But what does it mean, especially when it comes to living this good life, this life of pleasure and comfort? What does that mean, the good life, mean to live not just chasing, but to live given? Ecclesiastes 5:19, which is where we're going to spend the rest of our time here, says this: everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and to rejoice in his toil. Ecclesiastes 5:19 is so crucial here, because this is a different type of life he's talking about. So there's the under the sun life, that wheel of it just doesn't satisfy. But then there's this other view of life. And I just want to take some time this morning talking about the difference between the chasing life and the given life. Because what Ecclesiastes teaches us is not that the desire for the good life is wrong, but it defines what the good life is. The given life is the good life. Solomon steps up to the philosophical plate, and after eliminating a lot of different philosophies about how to get the good life, gives his own vantage point, and we see a peek at it in terms of this good life in Ecclesiastes 5:19. Okay, just some things I want to draw a distinction. What's the difference between the chasing life and the given life? The first, the chasing life, as we can hear in Solomon, the vision of life is that life is a race. It is a race to go and to get at the next level. Right? Solomon, if he was in modern business, would have an idea from very young about what do I need to get for grades here in order to get to my next thing here, in order to get into this school and to get into that internship and to give that. And he would have a heavy consciousness of how to climb. Right? He would have things mapped out in relationships and everything. But the thing that he would be chasing, just like the rabbit in front of the greyhound, would be next, next, next. And his vantage point would always be chasing. But see, the thing about a race is that you're running towards a goal always, but you're always looking next to the person to the right and to the left. The chasing life is ever conscious of comparison. Twice in our passage this morning in Ecclesiastes 2, it says, more than anyone before me. What's that mean? I'm not just after the gold, I'm ahead of that guy, right? More than, and then it says, and greater by far Not that I just got it here, but I lapped that girl, right? Like there's this sense of competition that's driving him in this race around the sun. That's what happens when we spend our lives just trying to get to the next pleasure, the next benchmark, the next thing in our 401k, that if that is our focus, that is our measure of what it means to give, like, we'll have that goal, but everywhere we go, we'll turn to the person next to him like, hey, how's it going for you? With no altruistic intent at all, except for to find out, where do I measure up? We ask the question of, am I the prettiest? Are my kids the best behaved or successful? Do I have my future set up like I want to? Am I the most spiritual in the room? Do I have the best or most friends? The life is a race. And this, I love this quote, right? Comparison is the thief of joy. And that's what he's ultimately saying. This race, and this even being better, but looking to your right and to your left because someone might be nipping at your heels, is not a joyful life. But the way he sets it up in Ecclesiastes 5, everyone to whom God has given, it's a life of being given. The other perspective is life is not a race, but life is a gift. Ecclesiastes ends 5:19, simply saying this is the gift of God. The good thing about the good life in recognition is that it is a gift, which means it has a giver. It means that there's someone else involved in this process. Secondly, the text will teach us that this, not only do we have a giver, but the giver's good. And Solomon will be able to say, and he has more than I had. The giver is bigger than I am. James 1:17 says, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, who doesn't change like shifting shadows. Life then is a gift to be enjoyed and discovered versus life being a race to simply win. And in this, because life is a gift, there's enough to go around. This is a deep principle of what it means to live under this God and with this God and to be his people. Is I don't have to be jealous of what's on your plate, and I don't have to just lean forward and try to steal the last piece of pizza, because there is enough to go around. To view life not just as the future of what I can get, not just as a comparison of what people have around us, but to live in the present, to recognize life is a gift. Wendell Berry says this, to treat life as less than a miracle is to give up on it. Secondly, whereas we see in Ecclesiastes 2 that there's this striving toil, right? And Solomon loves this word toil. He's like, oh man, it's not work, it's toil, right? I mean, he's all in on how hard life is and how life is work. But it's not just a word he uses in Ecclesiastes 2. He also uses it in this Ecclesiastes 5:19 we're using to compare the two types of life. He says there's a striving toil, right? That's what's described in Ecclesiastes 2. But in Ecclesiastes 5:19, it says to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God. Work is a part of the design. So there's a striving toil, but there's also an assigned toil. And this is what's super cool about this text. Solomon detailed out all the under the sun stuff in Ecclesiastes 2, right? That list of 10, he's saying that was all under the sun, me motivated, my ego oriented, my comfort, my pleasure. But that's not all the work that Solomon did. If you look in our texts of the history of Solomon in 1 Kings and in Chronicles, most, if at least half of the text is about the work that Solomon did to build the temple. The temple doesn't make the list of under the sun. Why? Why in our under the sun Ecclesiastes 2 passage is the temple not mentioned when scripture in talking about Solomon's story talks about the work of the temple so much? It's because the temple wasn't an under the sun assignment. It was work that was given. It took 6.5 years, an incredible amount of money, a giant workforce to accomplish the temple. But the temple wasn't what he would call meaningless work, striving toil. It was assigned. When we're talking about what Solomon eventually talks about as the good life, it's not a life without work. It's not a life spent just turning down promotions, living in a lotus position under a tree, eating spiritual figs. That's not what Solomon describes as the good life. It's not simply binge watching with a six pack and calling it self-care. He's saying that the good life includes work, but the work is different than the striving work. It's the assigned work. So what's the difference between chasing work and given work? One is the chasing work he details a lot, but I think the understanding our assignment as people is it's about being faithful to our God. That I do my work out of faithfulness to my God. That I drive to that day, and sometimes it's early morning, late night, or I'm going and doing this, or I'm dealing with this situation in my family. I'm doing my work, and it's often working harder than you might get in even the other type of striving work. But this type of given toil is done out of faithfulness and obedience. And then it also has this sense of release. I've done what I can, and whatever I get from it, I'm going to trust to God. And lastly, the type of assigned toil has God's help applied to it. The striving toil, I really believe that God looks at the striving toil and he's just like, go get him, champ. And just like wear yourself out. Spin around the wheel. And then when you're eventually exhausted, you're not going to get an assignment that doesn't have work in it. But you're going to have an assignment that I'm there to help you because I'm involved. I love Colossians 3, where it literally calls Christ our co-laborer. What does that mean? That we're co-workers together. We do it together. So yeah, there's a lot of work. Parenting's a lot of work. Providing for a family and having a job, it's a lot of work. Being a person is a lot of work. But that's part of the good life. The good life is not allergic to work. It's just work that's based in faithfulness, obedience, and it has God's help. Mike sent this out this Friday, and I was reading. I'm like, oh, I'll use that in his email. It's by Peter Greer and Jill Hesse. They say this, for Solomon and for us, a grander story begins when we let go of our own importance and self-sufficiency. We take our place in a grander story when faithfulness becomes more important than any other definition of success. Third, that we look at differences between the chasing life and the given life when it comes to this sense of pleasure. The chasing life is always after more. The motivation that is drummed up in the chasing life is more, more, more. We've been in Ecclesiastes 5 weeks. You've already caught that, right? It is a sense of like just more, better, bigger, faster, stronger. That is the motivation. Look at Ecclesiastes 5:19. It's so good. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil. This is the gift of God, to accept his lot. That the goal of the given life is the acceptance. First of all, that means accepting our human limitations. Fantastic book by Kelly Capick called You Are Only Human. One of the most difficult lessons of my life that God tries to teach me, and there's maybe not a lesson in my life that I buck more than this, that God designed me to be a limited person, that he designed my body to need things that slow me down. I literally, and this is what I'll say this, I said this week. I said to someone, I wish I could be a machine, because then I wouldn't have to deal with this other stuff. I could just accomplish the things I need to do. I could just serve the people I need to serve, and then I could do it without having any type of limitation, or because why? I view the work as so important. He didn't make me that way. God, our human limitations, Jesus talked about this in terms of even our crosses, they're intended. And so much of our goals under the sun is, how do I overcome my limitations? The given life says you're called to accept them. This means to also accept your limitations, but also to accept circumstances. I got to tell you, I hate my trash can in my house. I cannot clean this thing at the rate that it gets not clean. And I'm talking about the actual physical 13-gallon trash can that I have. There is a streak that goes down this stainless steel trash can that very obviously has stain on the steel, that if I scrub it, no matter how much I scrub it, whatever piece of refuse got dripped down the front of my trash can is like embedded like lava dripping into rock. And I go and I put trash in my trash can and I literally think, I just really hate this trash can. And it's got a lid that like goes down, but then it gets stuck up, so I have to see the trash. I don't want to see the trash. I hate my trash can. I have gone on and looked at more trash cans that you can imagine. And I've got a bigger family, so I'm like, well, I want a side-by-side. That's luxury. I want a side-by-side where trash and recycling go side-by-side. But a lot of the side-by-sides, they go down to like 8 gallons each. I don't want 8 gallons each, right? I want full, and the spot in our kitchen is under like the counter that I could fit this full trash can. It's all I want when I'm home. Except for a new dustpan. My dustpan is not wide enough to when I go in my trash can. But like this is so important. And they have these trash cans. Maybe you have one where like it's like fingerprint resistant. My trash can is not fingerprint resistant, right? I can see all the fingerprints and all the little ones from all the kids in my house, and it's just like, I just want a nice trash can, right? Like kids, take run of the house, give me my trash can. And I know you're sitting there and you're like elbowing like your wife and you're like, dude, Ben's embarrassing himself. Let's get him a Lowe's gift card for $100 and he can get his trash can. It's actually $134. But don't do it. Because my problems don't end with my trash can. My 2-year-old drew on the back of my couch. And if I would be fine with my trash can, I would get that couch so fast, right? And then when that is done, I'm going to have the next thing and the next thing. Because when I see that trash can, I say, you are the impediment to me having a sane day, right? I could take the rest, but not this. Close the lid! It won't close. But if it wasn't that, it's another thing. Accepting circumstances as they are is so important. We accept and we grieve what we don't have, and we accept again. We accept that we have crosses in our life. Some of you need to accept that you can't change your spouse. You have to accept the limitations of your children, which you wish they didn't have because you wanted them to be or have more. You need to accept that you were made differently than others. You have different limitations than others. I've been really open about the journey that has been mental health for me. I have more mental health problems than a lot of people in this room. I can't tell you how hard that is for me. But it's part of my cross. I can chase and want more, 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 better, or accept my lot and rejoice in my toil, because Ecclesiastes 5:19, that is the gift of God. That trash can and its stupid little drip stain, to accept that in my day is a gift of God for me, for my children. Accept your home for what it is. Accept your current lot. So much of the Christian life is accepting that no matter where you be and what you will have both light and shadow. Not asking you to ignore that you have shadow. I'm asking you to grieve it and to recognize that God uses even that as a part of his gifting. The last two were quick here, because these are more the response and the result of the difference between chasing and given life. The response to the chasing life is discontentment. I mean, this is literally the whole book of Ecclesiastes, the whole first five chapters of Ecclesiastes, is you try and try and try, and it just doesn't do it. But the response, Ecclesiastes 5:19 again, is rejoicing. To accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. The inner response to the chasing life is not happy about limitation. It's a miserable way to live. It's probably even more accurately an exhausting way to live. But the inner response, what automatically comes from a person who lives the given life, that views life as a gift, that accepts their assignment, and then accepts the limitation and the lot that they've been given, the response is gratitude. And I'm not asking you in this exercise to say you need to be more grateful. My question is, if you have trouble with gratitude, if that's a troubling response to come out of you, which side are you living on? And then lastly, the result of this life, not only discontentment, which is a state of being disappointment, which is more separating yourself out and looking at it and saying, I don't want to live that life. The chasing life, after Solomon had all that he got, he looked at it and he said, that's not the life I want. You know what he said? That life is not good. And this word is intentionally chosen here in the given life. The end of the good life, and I believe this again when we juxtapose Ecclesiastes 2 and then 5:19, is the good life is also a life of pleasure. That pleasure is not dogged here. And this sermon that Ecclesiastes gives is not giving a rebuke of pleasure, but a defense of it. It's not asking you to stop looking for the good life or the pleasant life or the pleasurable life, but to live the given life so you can actually find it. Psalm 16:11 says this, you have made known to me the path of life. Actually, crinkle it up. Yeah, turn there, would you? Psalm 16:11. You have made known to me the path of life, right? We're talking more in this, some philosophical terms here, right? The path of life. This is the path of life outlined by God. In this path, you will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. Very simply, the life that is lived with God is not a life that's above pleasure or beyond pleasure. It's a life that experiences pleasure. And just very quickly, just want to say how, as we close, how do we live this good life, a pleasurable life, a life with pleasures in it? What's the given life look? First thing is just simply We have to submit our pleasures and our treasures to God, which is way easier to say than to do, right? Simply, we have to submit our treasures and our pleasures to God. That's how we understand what pleasures He has for us. Secondly, we seek God as our pleasure. Catherine Wolfe, who's coming to do the women's retreat upcoming, and many of you are reading her book. Catherine had a massive stroke which completely altered her life. And she wrote a chapter that someone sent to me this week in the office. And I was like, this is exactly what I'm talking about. The chapter title is The Good Life. And she writes this. Before my stroke, I really loved Psalms 84:11, a verse that says, God withholds no good thing from those who walk with integrity. That verse became more confusing than inspiring the day I lost most of my physical capabilities. My ability to do motherhood the way I wanted, and my career. God was not merely withholding a good life from me, it seemed. He was taking my good life away from me. I would wrestle with this tension for years, both for myself and for everyone else who lives the world would call anything but good. Then my definition of good was turned upside down when I read the words of 16th century theologian Richard Baxter in The Good Things of God. He wrote this, "The good things of God are chiefly peace of conscience, joy in the Spirit in this life, fruition of God's presence and vision of His blessed face in the next." Because I can't resist alliteration, and I came up with a snappy way to remember Baker's meaning. Truly the good things in life are God's peace, presence, and provision in the process. When I dared to measure my circumstances with this new rubric, I found there was a good life on the other side of my suffering. I'm living it. Seeking God as our pleasure. And then lastly, seek with God to live into the pleasures He's designed for you. Means the pleasures that live according to your personality and design. Are you a water person? Are you a woods person? Are you the things that you actually enjoy? Enjoy them with God. He's given you those desires for enjoyment to so submit them. Find your pleasure in Him, but then live out those beautiful things that life goes according to our allotted resources and Holy Spirit guidance. I believe what Solomon, if he were here this morning, what he would say is don't avoid the good life. Find it. And chase as long as you need to come up with a mouthful of hevel and have a desire for living water. Because the given life is good. Won't you pray with me as we conclude? God, thank you for designing our lives, for giving us a good lot. Help us be people who want pleasure. Help us be people who have pleasure. Help us be people who live in that pleasure in a submitted and grateful way. And we pray you'll help us right here, right now, in this circumstance in our life, at this time in our life, at this present thing that we're facing, live these ancient words at the chief end of what it means to be a human being, the very goal and purpose of our life, is that we may glorify you by enjoying you forever. In Jesus' name, amen.